Hi, this is Paul, and a bunch of you will know who this guy is. This is Aaron Wren, and he has just recently released a book, Life in the Negative World, and I just spent the last hour sort of skimming through it, and go, there it is.
I'm holding it up for you here so people can actually see it.
It's on Kindle, and it's also on audio. Did you read the audio book?
I did not read the audio, but okay. There is an audio book, e-book, and hardcover. So,
okay. Yeah. Well, you're not a stranger to the channel. We met at a little event with the Chicago, they don't call themselves an estuary group, but I will. The Chicago Estuary Group, that was June of 2022 when I was heading out to Synod, I believe.
Yes.
And we did a video on the CRC Synod for your channel after Synod last year. And so, yeah, no stranger to this corner. Let's maybe by way of introduction, I first became aware of you with your newsletter, The Masculinist, which annoyed a bunch of people that I know in terms of just the title itself. It just kind of ruffled their feathers.
Yeah.
But tell me about the origin of that newsletter.
Sure. Well, I've had sort of three careers. Career number one was management consulting out of college. And I was mostly with Accenture. And then kind of after, 15, however many years I'd been doing it, I started writing a blog as a creative outlet. It was called The Urbanophile, The Lover of Cities. And I'd come from, rural Southern Indiana where I grew up and was living in Chicago. And I had a lot of thoughts about cities. I'd always been a prolific message board junkie, going back to the Usenet days when I was in college. And I found myself on these different, urban discussion boards, making long posts that I thought had interesting things to say. But I realized, this is just going to scroll up the page. It'll be gone forever. And so I said, I might as well start a blog where this stuff will be up there. And it was published under a pseudonym called The Urbanophile. Like the only time that I've ever written under a pseudonym, really. And it very quickly became very popular. And it sort of took off. And after about a year, somebody sent me a link to an international competition for ideas for boosting public transit ridership in Chicago, sponsored by the Chicagoland Chamber of Commerce. So I entered it and I won over like 125 people from around the world, got my picture on the cover of the Chicago Tribune above the fold. As I like to say, I got my picture on the cover of the paper while there was still a paper to get your picture on the cover of, all thanks to the Chamber's amazing PR team and nothing to do with myself. But then, my phone started ringing, government officials wanted to talk to me. There's a lot there. And I thought, well, maybe there's some kind of career here. So I ended up leaving Accenture to try to make something in urban policy space. And it's a very long and difficult journey, to be quite honest. It was vastly more difficult than I ever thought it would be. My life sort of kind of disintegrated shortly thereafter. I won't go into all that, but basically it was up to the Manhattan Institute, writing about urban policy, public policy. And then I saw a few things. One is I saw probably over a decade ago now, all these, young men turning to sort of online influencers for guidance. They certainly weren't turning to the church or any place like that. And, I realized myself, like, wow, I got nothing but basically bad advice from the church. It didn't work. And these guys actually seem to have some stuff that works. And so I put some of it into practice myself. I sort of completely rebuilt my idea of what it was to be a man. And of course I didn't adopt every perspective that some of those people had, but I'm like, wow, why are people are turning to these guys? This is even before anybody ever heard of Jordan Peterson. This is before the Genesis lectures, before anything. And
well,
so
this was much more in the Tim Keller days.
Yeah. Probably in the peak of his era. This is probably around 2013 or something like that.
Yep.
And so eventually I'm there in New York and I'm trying to decide what to do next. Cause I'm working for a nonprofit and I'm doing okay, but it's like, certainly not as much money as you'd like to have. And I was originally thinking I was going to start a for-profit website around microbiome gut health. I said, this is going to be a big thing. It's going to hit. And I'm true. I mean, I've actually been on the microbiome train for over a year, over a decade. And I really think that really is like really, really important from anti-inflammation. All the stuff people talk about now, I probably could have made money on that if I'd actually done it. And I said, instead, I will start a newsletter focused on these men's issues. I looked around. I said, is anybody talking about this stuff in the church? Nobody is talking about this stuff. Nobody. Now, as it turns out, there were actually a few people here and there that were saying things that I would have largely agreed with. And candidly, if I'd known about them, even though they weren't big, Alistair Roberts would have been one of those people. He was doing interesting things back at that time. I probably never would have even started this thing, but I sort of felt like it was a little bit like this Ezekiel situation. Like, if you know something and you don't say anything, then you're the one that's to blame. That's why I said, I'll start this newsletter. I had 35 people who are going to be on it because I had charter subscribers that I kind of hand selected. And I said, if this thing grows by word of mouth to 500 people in a year, then I will continue doing it. Otherwise, I'm going to shut it down. And I wasn't bashful about starting this newsletter because basically I'm like, I already sort of intellectually disrupted a space once and managed to be successful at it despite not having like a PhD or a political background or anything like that. I'm like, so I've never been intimidated about that sort of thing. For whatever reason, I've never been super impressed with credentials and things of that nature. Not to say that I don't think that many people with those credentials are incredibly smart. But nevertheless, I'm like, I'd already kind of done this once successfully. So I didn't feel, I'm like, I'm definitely going to do some things differently than I did the last time. One of them is I'm going to set these thresholds that if I don't hit these thresholds on these timeframes, I'm cutting my losses, so to speak. So I did it. And I called it the masculinist because I'd been the urbanophile. So I'm like, why don't I call it the masculinist? I couldn't think of what else to do. It wasn't really published under a pseudonym. It was published under my name, but it was like using like AWeber or one of the mailing list pieces of software. There wasn't even a website for it. And even when I first started putting up old issues, there were PDFs of printouts and it was on an unlinked web page. So it really was kind of like an underground newsletter. And I did get up to like 260 something, I think, subscribers by the end of year one. But it was not on track to hit it. And so I said, well, I'm just going to give my two best ideas and before I shut this thing down. And so one of them was the first version of my Three Worlds thesis. It was newsletter number 13. It's called The Lost Worlds of American Evangelicalism. So I put that up. I said, this is my best idea I've ever had, basically. Hmm. And I put this up. And then I wrote a final one about Nassim Taleb, which I thought was, another guy I had been an influence on me. And then I actually told my charter subscribers that I was shutting it down. And in fact, my wife and I said, okay, what we're going to do is we're actually going to have a celebration of a year of having done this thing. And we actually did a little formal celebration to call it the end. And so I did that. And then the weekend after that, going to get some ice cream, walking down Columbus Avenue in New York, going to get some ice cream. Place is probably like 20 minutes from our house. We get there. I get in line. I pick up my phone, waiting in line. I got 25 subscribers came in on my newsletter. Like, what's going on? And so I delete. Then I get some ice cream and sit down. And by the time I ordered my ice cream and sat down, I got 15 more subscribers come in. What's going on? So somebody must have mentioned me. So I Googled it. And somebody had sent that article to Rod Dreher, that Three Worlds of Evangelicalism article to Rod Dreher. He wrote a huge piece on it. He's like, you got to sign up for this thing. And I probably got like 2,500 subscribers within a week. And that really launched it, which I think that's really how the newsletter came to be. And then I ultimately, I put up a public website on it and also rebranded it after myself. I thought masculinist was too limiting. And, it really is. It was a little too edgy that, some people wouldn't. What I wanted is anything that I write, I one of the things that I always say is, can you forward this to your pastor? And everything that I write has to pass that test. It doesn't have to, even if you're a little, you could say, look, pastor, do you see this thing this guy wrote? What do you think of that? It doesn't have to be that it's like the ultimate saved content, but it has to sort of be safe for work. And, you know, the Masculinus really wasn't, it was overly limiting brand. So I rebranded it after myself, just called the Aaron Wren Newsletter. But I think what happened with Rod Dreher is a couple things that I think are relevant to me. One is it did sort of validate the Nassim Taleb thesis. That was like a black swan event, if you will. Mm-hmm. The one thing, you know, you spend your days plugging away, writing articles, and then there's the one viral hit that sends you all your traffic.
Yep.
So that's there. The second you can think of it is an example of Protestant re-enchantment, and that ultimately, you know, is that a miraculous intervention by God? I don't know that you necessarily need to think of it that way in terms of a Pentecostal sense, but undoubtedly, if God is sovereign, then, you know, he was well aware that I was shutting this thing down and all these things happened and this thing really did come up. I mean, so, but for that, I would have shut this thing down a year into it. And so, I think as we think about the re-enchantment thesis, which I really don't go into in my book, but as we think about like how the world is people are seeking that, maybe it's post-meta-modernity that people are looking for, as you might put it. I do think thinking about ways to reframe events into a valid Protestant re-enchantment context or one of them. So I would certainly view this as an example of Protestant re-enchantment.
I did highlight in your book a comment where you sort of connected Nassim Taleb with where was it? Yet if we have two vocabulary substitutions, we might translate Taleb's claim, a Christian way of thinking, first is replaces concept of randomness with sovereignty of God, and second replace black swan with room for God to show up in ways we can't imagine. So,
sort of how I think of it. And yeah. If the world, you know, if you look at Taleb's arguments, I mean, one of his arguments is that the world is fundamentally random. And that outcomes are driven. His book, Fooled by Randomness, I have highly recommend it. It's like we think that these guys got rich because of some great superpower that they had. The reality is most people got rich who got rich because of random chance.
Yep.
We dramatically underplay the role that random chance plays in the world. And again, this is like there are so many things. Like I met my wife because I visited this church three times as I was looking for a place to go to church after moving to Indianapolis in 2014. And somebody who knew us both just happened to introduce us and said, oh, you have some mutual interests around urban policy because she was running the land bank for the city of Indianapolis. Why don't you two get together? Now, of course, I immediately deduced that she has an ulterior motive for connecting us. But like, if I hadn't gone to church those three Sundays, would we have ever met? See, we start realizing like all of the small things there.
Yep.
And so the real question is, how do we, if the world is, as Taleb says, fundamentally random, that's a pretty bleak way to think about our own sense of, you know, he has sort of a weak sense of human agency, I think, in his work. And, you know, where, so do you want to, we like to think of ourselves as like having all this agency that we are able to, you know, be the master of our fate, the captain of our soul and all this stuff. But the reality is, you know, you run into, a storm and all of a sudden you realize, wait a minute, I'm not that good anymore. Is that what happened? Like I ended up spending like 3 years where literally nothing went right in my life. No matter what I did, nothing worked. I'm like, okay, you think you're smart. Now let's see. What it's like God saying, now let's see how smart you are, buddy. And nothing works. And so I think, you know, once you realize, oh, I have no, my power over my own existence is much lower than I thought it was. Then you start thinking, well, wait a minute, what if there is a God? And what if he actually is in charge of the world? And wouldn't that be a safer and better place to be than this very random place that Taleb mathematically demonstrates is actually true? And so I think his ways of thinking about things are very, very friendly to Christianity. And one of my, I think in that newsletter I wrote, which was newsletter 14, it's called An Anti-Fragile Church. I mentioned, I think I started off with some Google searches of how many hits there were for different sites. How many times has First Things magazine mentioned Nassim Taleb? Zero. How many times has the Gospel Coalition mentioned him? Like zero. Christianity Today, zero. Now, First Things actually came back and did a big article on Taleb later. But like they had totally not engaged with his work at all. And again, the black swan idea. It's like the idea that God is not constrained to save by many or by few. And these seemingly random events that have incredibly outsized determinations of our overall outcomes. You know, very powerful. So that to me has been something that has really, and again, I think everybody's theology is an attempt to make sense of their own life at some level. And, we have to, we have to somehow reconcile ourselves. Okay, how do we defend God's character in light of, our own experiences, in a sense? And so my experiences have very much been in line with the Taleb points of view. I have not had these master plans that I executed and like, boy, am I not great at how well I executed this plan. So many things. If you'll indulge another story, I'll tell you another story.
Yeah, go ahead.
This that gives you a sense of my life. So I was in college and I was a finance major by default. I became a finance major because I ruled everything else out. But I realized that as I came to the end of my studies that if I had to spend like the rest of my life as like a loan officer in a bank, I'd blow my brains out. And in the meantime, I had started like learning computers. I'd always liked computers, even when I had a Commodore 64 and all that. And I'd really gotten into hacking into computer labs. I'd stay up all night writing software. And there was like a community of people there. I was like, what I really like doing is programming computers. I wish I could program computers. So I'm looking for a job and like, what am I going to do? And so this is 1992. So it's still coming out of a recession. There aren't that many jobs out there. And, I apply for a job. I said, somebody sent me a job posting for a land administrator, a network administrator on the Indiana University's campus, paid $8 an hour. And I'm like, I'm going to apply for that because I really want to work in computers. This is the only computer job I know. But I also, everybody at the business school where I graduated wanted to work one of two places. They either wanted to be a brand manager at Procter & Gamble, or they wanted to work for a consulting company called Anderson Consulting, which is now Accenture. And they're so huge. So I was like, oh, I guess everybody wants to interview. I'm like, I'm not going to be a brand manager. I'm not a marketing guy. Well, what about this consulting thing? So I sign up for an on-campus interview. And I'm like, what do these people do? So this is really before the web. So you go to get their literature out of the placement office. And it's like, we help our clients change to be more successful. And all kinds of similarly uninformative statements about what this company does. So then I go to my interview. I was like, oh, let's find out here. So then I get there. He goes, Aaron Wren, are you on the radio? And I said, well, actually, I'm not on the radio, but they say my name on the radio because one of my jobs is an audio engineer for our NPR station on campus. So then we spend 30 minutes talking about classical music. And he's like, oh, I'll send you up for an interview. So then they say, let's go to Chicago for an on-site interview. So I go to Chicago and they bring me in for like half a day. I fly up there, have an interview with this guy who I later worked for. And Dan Beagley, and all he does is spend our entire interview pounding the table, spinning. This is the best effing consulting company on the effing planet. And if you don't effing work here, you're an idiot. Any other questions? No. And so I like this all day. And I left this company literally not knowing what the company did. And that's the very last person, a closer, Cheryl Sunderman. I still remember all these people's names. She's like, well, do you have any last questions for me today? You can get answered. I'm like, well, I don't know what this company does, but I'm sure not going to ask that question. So I leave. And then I'm like waiting to hear back on my land administrator. So I get a job offer from them in Chicago. And then I'm, waiting to hear this land from administrator job. I don't hear them. I don't know what this consulting company does, but if I get this land administrator job, I'm just going to turn down that offer in Chicago because like I want to work in computers. So I finally ping the land people and I don't get the job. They're like, oh yeah, you didn't get that job. I'm like, all right. So I guess I'll take this consulting job. And then I show up in Chicago. When you know it, all this company does is install computer systems for large corporations. And I say that because the whole time this was going on, I was praying to get that land administrator job. I had never prayed. And to this day, I have never prayed more in my life to get a particular thing than that. And it didn't happen. And I wasn't upset about it. Like, well, it was probably like, should I do it? But like the thing is, like the thing I'm asking for, it's like, no, we're not going to give you that. And so this was like literally, if I gotten a job as an $8 an hour land administrator on IU's campus, I would have turned down. My entire life would have been completely different.
Yeah.
So many little things like that that we don't appreciate.
Yep.
And that just some random thing or, and so this has been the experience of my life that like the best things that happened were all things like it wasn't anything I did.
Yep.
And so that's why I think Taleb resonates with me so much more than maybe it would with someone who like makes plans and executes them successfully, which has not been my experience.
Well, I just dug up one of the beautiful things about email is I just dug up my first reference of you. And sure enough, I found you via the Rod Dreher post of October 21, 2017. And I shared that onto this listserv that I've participated in for a long time, CRC Voices. Some people were immediately offended by the title of the newsletter, but I thought the content was really good. And that's when I signed up for it and bang, there it was. Yep. But what you say is so true. And I see that all the time in just about every area of life. Whereas in sort of the projected consciousness in our culture, you know, it's be prepared, plan, do all of these things. And there's value in all of those things. I'm not going to undermine that, but I completely get your story with respect to this. And it makes just perfect sense.
What ends up, if you don't be, you end up like really, over, you know, it's pride ultimately is you think that everything that you're accomplishing is it's happening because of what you're doing.
Yeah.
And it gets back to like Deuteronomy 8, you know, where God says, don't forget that I'm the one who's giving you all of this stuff. And don't become proud and think that it was you who did that. And is it Hosea where he's talking about, you know, one of the, you know, was that the one who married the prostitute?
Yeah.
And you know, she's like off with this guy. And of course, the metaphor for Israel.
Yep.
And, you know, she's getting all this like great stuff from him, but it's really kind of God sneaking up behind her and delivering all this stuff. And like, they're not even aware that like, you think you're prospering because of what you're doing, but that's not actually the case at all. And you become very proud about your own abilities to do things when you don't realize it's like, unless the Lord builds the house, those who build it labor in vain, or apart from me, you can do what? Nothing.
Nothing.
And so you got to remember those things, because if you don't remember those things, you start thinking you're like a really smart guy. And like, this is all of my genius that made this happen.
That's right.
It was my genius insight that that made this Three Worlds piece a hit, as opposed to, that doesn't mean we're not supposed to use our talents. We're not supposed to be diligent and all that stuff we're called to do. But like at the end of the day, you know, as again, it's like Christ who gives the increase. If you don't think about that, you really overestimate how much power we have in this world.
I want to talk about your insight that you had early on, and you very much continued it, that men have been getting bad advice from churches.
Mm-hmm.
Because, and you know, one of the things that I really appreciate about you is while, you know, you very much tend to be, a lot of your audience is quite conservative, you don't seem to have any problem telling conservatives counter narrative, counter narrative assertions that, you know, and it's funny because people are often only vaguely half listening. And so sometimes you'll say something to someone that you think they should really hate this. And they just kind of like, it just kind of goes by them. But the point that you just made early on, that you discovered early, that churches weren't giving men very good advice. You've continued to make that point about evangelicals and some of their posture with respect to men and women. What was it like for you when you first came to that conviction that the advice I'm getting from my church is not good advice? What were the tells of that? And then, you know, what then did you do about it? And what kind of pushback did you get?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it didn't really occur to me that the advice was bad, but I had some kind of, disastrous dating experience and we'll go all that. And it's like, well, this was bad. And again, I think the net what happens, and I see this happen a lot with Christian men, is, they have some disastrous relationship or their wife divorces them or something of that nature happens. And the very first thing they do is they start blaming themselves. If, only I had been more of a servant leader, this would not have happened. And I think when we go looking for fault with ourselves, we almost always find it because we tend to do, we're human beings. And so it's like, wow, what are all the things I did wrong? Well, I can make a really long list of that. And you make the point that it's the long list. And that long list might be completely accurate, but, and it might also be completely, completely wrong in a greater scheme of things. And so, none of this teaching on gender, when I put it into practice, had produced good results. And I probably was inclined to blame myself because I could say, here's like horrible things or whatever that I've done. And then again, you see, then you encounter, maybe your average manosphere person who says, actually, this is the way relationships work. And if you're tempted enough to put that into practice and you discover that indeed it does work, then, like, wow, like what's going on there? And that's why I think, I really think that the gender stuff online is the most important lever for changing people's point of views in a number of directions, because our relationships with the opposite sex are primal. And if someone tells you how you can become more successful with women and you're a guy, you're the so-called average frustrated chump, and you consider yourself lucky if a woman actually looks at you and will, respond to your, emails or will any of that stuff. And then somebody says, actually, what you have to understand is that women are looking for men that are higher status for themselves. And so rather than getting on your knees and giving them a dozen roses and treating them to fancy dinners, what you need to be doing is doing everything to establish a frame and a point of view, which sees you as the catch, that she sees you as like the star athlete that she's desperate to be with. And you're actually like telegraphing exactly the wrong message when you do things like, here, let me like buy you expensive dinners. When you're in this aggressive suitor mode, you're constantly telegraphing that you're lower status than her. And women actually want to marry up. They want to date up. Now, of course, many of these guys who are saying this stuff are actually all about like pickup artistry. So they're in the service of that. But you can think about that. And you're like, oh, that makes sense. And then if you actually apply it and it works, and, which it does, to be quite honest. I mean, within 30 days, if you're like an average frustrated chump guy, just by applying some basic readily available online, ideas about how to attract women, you can very easily improve your dating results literally by 10x. And so when you can have 10x improvement in a day, and then once that happens, you're going to believe anything else those people tell you because you think they're prophets. And, that is a big part of it. And it's the sort of thing you can't fake. And that's why the other thing is it's primal. It's the sort of thing you can't fake. So if somebody puts up a post that talks about structural racism in the United States and says, we have this problem with structural racism, and, we had redlining and we had blockbusting and we had, urban renewal and all this stuff. And then somebody else says, well, no, we don't have structural racism. And here's why. This is critical race theory. You can listen to these things, just like you can listen to debates on trade policy or many other things. But there's no way to really objectively verify who's telling you the truth. Because in any of these things, it's like, well, you got to have 25 different controls in order to, make sure that you got the right to use the right measure of inflation and all this stuff. So it's purely kind of like tribal. It's they're articles of faith in a sense. But when it comes to meeting someone, of the opposite sex, you know, you can try this stuff for yourself in like put it into practice and see, does it work or does it not work? The same thing is true of fitness and diet advice. Does it work or does it not work? Although I think with there, it's even less the case. A lot of these guys, online influencers, are very in the fitness space as well, and like all the food and other stuff. And really the truth is, if you do nothing and then all of a sudden you're doing any sort of workout, it's going to seem like it's transformational. So it's like, there's a lot of things you can do, and there's a lot of placebo effects with a lot of changes you make like that, but there's no faking, you know, being in a coffee shop or a bar or any public setting and being able to initiate a conversation with a woman and have her respond positively. She's either going to respond positively or she's going to respond in some other way. You can't fake it. And so, and you can prove it to yourself, and it's in something that's primal. And so I think when you see that, it's a fact of the universe that you can anchor to in a way that you can't anchor on to any of this other stuff. Even the Taleb stuff, it's like, well, is that really true? Or is this just some random thing that made it seem like what he was saying was true, to, you know, kind of get meta there? It's like, there's so much stuff you can't say, but like, you know, and you could even chalk it up. You know, I got one date with one woman. Well, now when it happens for the fifth time, it's like, actually this works. And so I think that is really, it's really the master switch in terms of causing people to rethink anything and opening them to rethinking the world. Is refactoring their things, their thinking on gender. And so I see this all the time. You know, I see people and, you know, in churches who are single and unhappily single, male or female. And I say, I don't actually say it because I don't give people unsolicited advice, but I can just see that like these people are clearly going in the wrong direction. Everything they're doing is counterproductive to the goals that they're setting. And so there's a lot of stuff like that that I think is very, you know, very clear. And then, of course, the other thing that you learn, you know, if you do any sort of reading, is all the facts they're not giving you in church. You know, so, oh, by the way, you know, women initiate about 70% of all divorces. It's one of the most well-established statistics in social science. You will never hear a pastor say that in a sermon on, you'll never hear it in one of their marriage books. I read Tim Keller's marriage book the first time. It was one of these things they gave me. I'm like, oh man, this is so amazing. I need to put this into practice. You know, then I read it with a critical lens and I'm like, this thing's full of more holes than Swiss cheese. And like, you know, the book's full of stats. And of course, they don't give you that stat. And so many of the ways that they frame it and so many of the ways that they talk about different things, I was like, well, you can just see how you're kind of being like misled here, manipulated here, manipulated there. And so you realize like these guys are not really giving you the straight dope at the end of the day. They're, you know, not to say that they're deliberately, you know, they're deliberately misleading you. I think, you know, most of these people, I think, are just repeating what they've heard everybody else say from like the big name. But you can believe the biggest name people in the evangelical world, 100% have heard the Minority Report. Okay. It's not like they're reading some blog post of mine and this is the first time they've ever heard, you know, that women are not attracted to servant leadership. They know, believe me, 100%. Because, you know, I, you know, sometimes I come across some of these people who've called them out on it, and I know they know who these people are. And but the average person, you know, the average pastor is just repeating what he's heard. And so I think basically, you know, you see these things, and you're like, yeah, why are men turning to Jordan Peterson? What I find is just how little curiosity the average person in the religious world, how little curiosity they have about why people turn to Jordan Peterson, why they turn to these people. They have they've never really thought about it. And it'd be like, wow. And in fact, I mentioned yesterday, you know, I went to the Jordan Peterson, you know, event here in Indy, and, you know, wasn't his best event. I don't think he's ever done, but, you know, and it made me go back, and I went back and rewatched his message to the Christian churches, which I think was the very first thing he ever put out when he signed on with Daily Wire. And it's a very condescending, hectoring lecture. And what I realized is he starts it out. I'd forgotten this part. He starts it out talking about his own Genesis lectures. Basically, yeah, I rented out a theater in Toronto to give this series on Genesis. Let's see. Oh, yeah, it was sold out. Everybody came. These things went viral. Millions of people have watched them. In other words, actually, I'm much more successful at teaching people about the Bible than you guys are. my sermon, my lectures go viral. Your lectures don't go viral. I'm actually, the market has judged that I am the authority, not you. So you should listen to me because they're actually coming to me, not you. So you should be doing what I tell you. And of course, people don't want to hear that. And the truth is, though, he's in a sense right. The market, you know, and again, if we apply the Taleb filter on it, the Jordan Peterson story is in part an artifact of randomness and other things. And in fact, I think there's sort of a hidden backstory on Peterson that is not yet fully been revealed. But you know, the truth is, yeah, he got hot, and getting hot is like in part of there's a random element to that. But you know, his stuff is actually, there's a lot of things you can just look and see what he does. And you know, and so, but there's no curiosity whatsoever. Nobody's interested at all in like why Jordan Peterson is that good. And that's one of the things like Alistair Roberts was doing back in 2016. Here's why people are going to Jordan Peterson. I think you got very interested in, you started doing your videos on account of Jordan Peterson.
Yep.
And it's like so unusual, even today, just like, it's just like people don't really care. It was just weird. They're like, why, when you want to know why people are turning to Joe Rogan, why they tune into Joe Rogan, why do they tune into Jocko Willink? You know, why are they tuning into these different people? I actually think Andrew Tate is one of the least interesting people just because, you know, his appeal is mostly to teenage boys. And I think, you know, there's an obvious reason that it appeals to the teenage boy, but that's not the Jordan Peterson appeal. Again, the median age of the Jordan Peterson thing I attended was like 35 to 40. And that probably higher than his audience, because you got to have the money to go to a lecture. And let's face it, probably like 20 something people don't go to lectures, like pay money to go to a lecture, but it still shows like what's going on. And so I feel like it's really interesting to me, like how little curiosity these people have about why they're so ineffective in the marketplace. You know, and I've been trying to get people's attention on that, but they don't seem very interested.
I suspect, well, I had a very similar experience in that when I saw what was going on with Jordan Peterson, I thought, this is, I don't know why every pastor I know isn't, hang on a second. I got a guy taking care of my dog. So I found you via Rod Dreher. I found Peterson. I believe I found him via Rod Dreher. And when I began listening to Peterson and in fact, seeing what was going on around him and listening to people that were finding him and the changes they were making in their life, I thought, this is like a once in a ministry career opportunity to really engage a whole bunch of people about all the kinds of things that a Christian minister should be interested in. And I started talking to my colleagues about it. And as you said, many of them just sort of were like, oh, and they went on with their business. And I thought, You're in churches that are dying, and you go years and years without having a single really interesting evangelistic missionary conversation. And so I made a video, and then suddenly I had more conversations than I had time to have. And that lack of curiosity, I sometimes wonder if it isn't a product of basically the dynamics of conservative religion. Because conservative religion, in a sense, sort of trains you to stick within a couple of really hard boundaries. And after you started listening to Jordan Peterson, you know, when I first heard about him, it was like, is this some evangelical that somehow is in University of Toronto psychology department? You listen to him, he's like, no, he's not an evangelical at all. And then it was, okay, well, why so little curiosity about this? And I shouldn't be unfair to the few of my colleagues that also were quite interested in them. Very few people decided to go to YouTube and talk about it. But I also thought that YouTube had a piece in this dynamic as well, that there was something about YouTube, because I'd been reading Neil Postman's Amusing Ourselves to Death, which was written about cable television a generation before. And so, and then, as you said, with respect to, you know, whether it's randomness or the providence of God, or, you know, I actually released a very poorly made video at exactly the right time, the timing of which I could never have anticipated. And so then the algorithm took me on a journey that I saw a few other pastors do exactly the same thing, and it just didn't go anywhere, but right. Mine did. I'm curious. Yeah,
the other thing is this conservative religion. My friend Dwight Gibson, which I refer to in the book, and his exploration concept is he always talked about, like, we're so in modern American society steeped in a management mindset. To which that I would add engineering. It's design. It's like we do things. We only do things that we know how we're going to do them. And it's only in like the startup world or like the 0-to-1 world or like the people try to get out of the box. I think this idea that like there's a world bigger than what we can comprehend, that the universe is just much bigger than we think, that just doesn't compute. I mean, anything that is like outside of the known material of these guys, it's not really, people just don't, they're not that interested in it.
Yeah. I haven't made a video yet today for tomorrow, but we spoke before about the Christian Reformed Church. I just had a regional meeting of our church in a little town called Ripon, California. That's about an hour south of here. It's sort of the hub of the Christian Reformed Church here because Dutch immigrants settled there to do dairy work, and then they got into the almond business. And so that's sort of always been the hub of it in this area of the country. And when I got to this, when I moved to Sacramento 27 years ago, the population was probably about 4,500. My guess is the population is now more like 16,000 because between, you know, since 97 and now, there's been just a flood of people moving from the Bay Area, buying houses, doing commuting. And the size of those churches is smaller than when I moved here. And it's smaller for a variety of reasons. There have been some split offs and some things going. Some of the churches have done some effective evangelism. Other churches have just lost their young people. And I want to be careful with this because I'm not really trying to blame the pastors. You know, I respect the pastors, and most of the pastors are doing a competent job, but when I look at the changes in that town that I've seen in just 27 years living an hour away, I can probably see them more easily because I only visit there a few times a year. I think this should be an existential crisis, a felt crisis for the churches. And I never get the sense that it is by virtue of how they behave. And I did have a sense. So when I came back to North America after doing overseas mission work, I did have a sense that the seeker movement had some of that energy in them, that they at least were, and on some levels, thinking aggressively, willing to take risks, do some of that. And I get the sense in many conservative religious groups, they're mostly turned in, mostly continuing to fight amongst themselves over important issues that they have, but very little thinking about the kinds of changes that are going on. And this probably leads us more into your book, the kinds of changes that are going on in our culture around us that should radically reshape the way we think about evangelism and ministry, and even just maintaining a community within a pluralistic space. And I really liked how you sort of, I think you laid things out well in your book. And again, I was able to sort of skim your book in about an hour, and because I've read you before. Talk to me a little bit about not only with the book, but also in your early days with The Masculinist. What kinds of things did you do that you found productive in terms of provoking insights that over time now have been validated and proven correct?
That's interesting. You know, I am not autistic, although I'm towards that end of the spectrum of normal, if you want to call it that. And, you know, one of the things that's, I think very clear is that the average person is very unwilling to say anything that positions them outside of the group. You know, people are, you know, we always like go along with the trends. We repeat what everybody else is doing. And it's really rare for people to be willing to say something that's outside of that realm. Peter Thiel's got this line from Zero to One that his one of his favorite interview question is, what very important truth do very few people agree with you on? He's like, that's a hard question to answer because, you know, by definition, you know, the things people agree on, right, are, yeah, you know, that's most things. And then if people don't agree on it, it's probably unpopular. And so you find an important truth that is also an unpopular truth and is disagreed on. He's like, it's harder question than you think. And his line there is, brilliant thinking is rare, but courage is an even shorter supply than genius. And I am not a courageous person by any means, but I've got that sort of autistic ability to say, wait a minute, I think there's actually like, you know, four lights there, four fingers, whatever the thing is, it's like, you know, this is not right. There's something off here. And so I tend to see my brain works like, it's like there's a huge hopper on top of it and all this stuff is just coming into the engine and it's getting digested. And then I make these connections between different things and that's how things pop out, you know, really. And so a big part of it is really just the natural way that my mind works to make connections between things, you know, sort of like draw relationships and parallels and tease out kind of underlying relationships. And then the willingness to say it, I think, is another thing that I have. I'm pretty good at is, again, explaining things that I think about in ways that people can say, even if I disagree with him, I at least understand why he thinks that way. Because I go through, here's why I think this way. It's point one, point two, point three, you know, too many points probably. But it's like well thought out. It's like there's rationale behind it. It's not intended to. So I spend a lot of time thinking about how to communicate these things in ways people could come in and able to see it to do that. I also, I don't know if it's about productivity, but other things like I am kind of contrarian, but I tend to be like, you know, I tend to be very equal opportunity and like that things I'm not tribal in any respect there. And I try to like explicitly wrap that up. And then some of the things that I've done that I think have been successful have been things that were sort of almost accidents. So one of them was, I was actually the very first thing I wrote was actually not my newsletter. The very first thing I wrote was a commentary on 2 Timothy, because I said 2 Timothy is essentially the Bible's premier treatise on what it means to be a man. So you've got Paul, this, you know, it's like he's writing, the father writing a letter to his son. Paul is now in jail. He's coming to the end of his days. And Timothy's kind of in trouble. You know, it's a little uncertain where Timothy is and all that's going on. But Timothy's got some issues. I mean, if he's still, where was it? Ephesus? Was that where he was in 1 Timothy? If he's still there and it's later, things have gone very, very poorly for him. And so, and he's always like, you need to kindle, refresh, all this stuff. And so he goes through and sort of gives him this list of things that he needs to be doing. At the same time, Paul himself is modeling all of those things by the behaviors that he's exhibiting while he's in jail. I'm in jail. I'm going to be executed. All my friends have abandoned me. But here I am. I'm still worried about you. I'm still trying to show the. So there's a lot of stuff in there that I think is very good. It's sort of like, here's my, you know, although he's kind of sounds like he's hopeful to meet Timothy again, because he's like, bring me my stuff when you come. He is sort of like, you know, maybe this is the last thing I'll ever get to tell you. So I'm going to give you all of my wisdom. So I wrote a commentary on 2 Timothy that I never published. And I was actually going to publish it, but I decided not to do that because I never really reached exactly the way I wanted it to be. And then ultimately I decided, you know, I'm not going to try to be a Bible teacher or theologian. I'm going to operate in this different genre. And I think that was a good thing to do, because if I really try to debate these people in the Bible, they'd mutilate me, because they're so much more educated in that than I, not that I don't know anything about this stuff, but like, you know, they have me spinning around. And so like, I think by saying I'm a cultural critic or whatever, like now I'm on ground that they have no, they can't claim any particular expertise on. They can't claim that their, you know, MDiv gives them any special insights into the nature of today's world. And so that was like a big thing. And then the other thing that I did, again, I come up with these guiding principles of how I wanted to do things, which was to, live not by lies, which Rod took was obviously from Solzhenitsyn, was actually my first principle. Like, we're going to tell the truth here. We're not going to like, the second one is we're going to build up. We're not just going to tear down. And actually I took that one away from another kind of Christian blogger who'd come before, who was just negative. So negative all the time. Like, nobody wants to hear all this negative stuff. You got to give people some stuff that helps them. So although I don't think I'm the best life coach, I still write stuff like that. Here's some insights on mentoring or something, because I want people to. So there were little things that I think played to my advantage over time, but a lot of it is really just natural. It's not some great thing that I did. But I am always, looking for the deep cut material that's, everybody's got like their standard influences, Rene Girard or Charles Taylor or some of these guys, all these people. Like, I want to find influences that nobody else has read. Like my reading of E. Digby Baltzel,
yep,
is like a guy that nobody else read. Now, yep. And as it turns out, he actually has quite a cult following, actually. But the fact is that's not something that other people are seeing. So I like to try to look for influences that are, off the radar, so I can add in some things that, other people don't have, give those insights on the problem. So those are a few things I would say that I've done.
How much audience engagement did you get from The Masculinist?
Obviously people were forwarding it. A lot of people were forwarding it because it did spread pretty well by word of mouth, I think, initially. It wasn't like there was like a like button on the original newsletter or something like that, but I did get a lot of emails from people on it. So I got a decent amount of engagement, I would say. One thing I do think I have lower engagement than some other people in some respects. So I'll try to like do a Q&A thread, but I can't get people to ask me questions. Like, that's kind of weird. Like, the fact is I'm willing to like answer a lot of questions that like other people don't want to touch, but it's not like a lot of people get these great mailbag threads or these great, I don't seem to get people don't like come to me, Aaron, I really want you to tell me about this. Tell me about that. They love what I have to say. But I don't think I have the highest engagement. I have decent engagement. Uh-huh. There were 45 likes on my last one, but that I did as of this morning, that was less than 24 hours old. But I don't get massive engagement. And I think to some extent, like, the era of engagement has kind of declined a lot. When I was writing the Urbanophile, my blog on cities, the comment threads were some of the best comment threads anywhere. I mean, like, incredible, like, thoughtful conversations. And that just doesn't like exist today in the way that it did, in the past. So if you have any like great, I mean, I get good commenters, yeah, but like, it's just not as many, and it's not what it used to be.
Yeah. I actually have a lot of thoughts about that, but I'm also curious now your transition then to Substack. What was your thinking there?
Well, I originally, that's a good question. I originally had set my, because my it was just a newsletter, so there was right. Nothing else to it.
Right.
And then there was then I created a website on WordPress. So I was blogging on WordPress. Yep. I had a YouTube channel. I set up a podcast. Wasn't really integrated. The website never really took off in terms of readership. And so I'm like, well, this, I spent like a year and as like, cause I was like, I've been a pretty good blogger. Of course, Google really killed blogging.
Yeah.
It was like a lot, blogging kind of like didn't assist it. Substack, the Substack thing sounds kind of interesting. Maybe I'll try Substack. It's getting hot. And so I migrated to Substack. And so it actually turned out, you know, it turned out to be like a great move, to be quite honest. It just Substack was just a really great fit, and Substack itself was taking off.
Yep.
And so it became a good platform. I have a lot of issues with Substack in terms of, basically it's a walled garden. It doesn't really have any integrations with third party stuff. It doesn't have a lot of mailing list features and this and that. So I have a lot of, the high payment fee structure actually doesn't bother me as much as the lack of some of the features that I would like to have.
Yeah.
So I still haven't been able to fully, I still have a lot of manual integrations that I do. It was just something I was going to experiment with, moving to Substack, and it turned out to be like really, it went really well.
At what level is this for you now? Is this sort of a hobby? Do you have a day job that you do, and then you're doing this, the newsletter, the Substack, the podcast, the YouTube? Is that all on the side, or are you doing this as a...
This is basically my full-time job. Essentially as a writer. I'm with American Reformer, this nonprofit. So I'm like a think tank person there. So I'm involved with American Reformer. But much of what I do is just writing and things of that nature. And of course, there are still other things that I do. I do a lot of writing for other people. I get asked to speak at various events.
Yep.
I've got a lot of different, as they would always tell you online, you got to have multiple revenue streams. So I do have multiple revenue streams, if you want to call it that.
Yep.
But my main focus is essentially, my own media empire, if you will. Which is to the point that it is minimally sustainable at that level. So if everything else went away, I actually there's enough money coming in to actually live on.
Okay.
Which is good.
How did the book come about? Did someone approach you to write it, or is this something that you decided you wanted to develop into a book because you had enough material?
People told me 15 years ago, they kept telling me, when are you going to write a book? And I never wrote a book. And one of the reasons I never wrote a book is, it's going to take 2 years for a book to come out. I don't know what I'm going to be doing in 2 years. I can't commit to be doing this for another 2 years.
Yeah.
And then I never really had a great idea. And then finally, I think it was 2022.
Yep.
One of my goals for the year, I'm like, I have to write a book. That's got to be one of the things that I do. And so the Three Worlds article came out, and I said, I'm going to turn it into a book. And I had an agent, I had had some preliminary conversation with agents, and the guy that is my agent had actually reached out to me to talk about it. And then I marketed it in a traditional way through my agent. There was great publisher interest, and was delighted to place it with Zondervan Reflective. And, my goal really at the time was, I need to write a book. I just be totally honest. I'm like, I should write a book. And the classic way of having a magazine article that's a hit and making it a book, like, that's what I'm going to do. And I really wanted to do it. I also wanted to be with Zondervan. The main reason was, I wanted to be as main, I wanted to really target the evangelical world specifically. And I wanted as mainstream and broader reach a publisher as I can to reach the people I'm not reaching today. I want to be able to break outside of the networks and the people that I'm reaching and expose the book to new audiences, which it's doing. And so, of course, I also happen to think that this, the Three Worlds idea is really very important. And the people who've encountered it really, really like it. They're actually, so in the book, I talk about three different tribes, if you will, of evangelicals. This isn't exhaustive, and not everybody fits cleanly into one. But I talk about the culture warriors. I talk about the seeker sensitives, who are sort of the megachurch, suburban, non-denominational suburban megachurch crowd. And I talk about what I call the cultural engagers, who are the cultural elites, the urban folks, the intelligentsia class, basically. You can think of them that way. And if you look at that group of people, the culture war people have not engaged with my work at all, basically.
Really?
And very, very little engagement with it. The only people that I would classify as culture war who've really done a lot with it are like the Moscow, Idaho people around Doug Wilson.
Yep.
So if you think about all of the people who were profiled negatively in Tim Alberta's work and like his new book, The Kingdom, the Power, and the Glory, none of them have actually engaged with my work. None of them, which is interesting. Like, you know,
why
not even
would
like
that be? That really surprises me.
One, I don't think that they read, to be quite honest. I think that they listen to talk radio and podcasts, and they're probably driven by social media in their, you know, yeah. But some of their work, it's like, you know, I've never even got a mention from Eric Metaxas, who I actually know. He and I actually used to go to church together in New York. And, you know, I haven't asked him because I'm not like, you know, a, you know, I don't really care, to be quite honest with you. Yeah. He's not obligated. Nobody is covering it. But like, even guys like that, you know, I'm not getting, you know, I'm not, you know, the Daily Wire crowd.
Yeah.
You know, now I've gotten some from The Blaze because I know people at The Blaze. So some of The Blaze people are doing it. But basically, you know, there's a massive group of people in the culture war space that by and large, it's not that they disliked it.
Yeah.
I don't think they've read it. Yeah. I don't think they read First Things magazine. That's what I'm thinking.
Yeah. Yeah.
I do think maybe a lot of the, you know, more senior people have read it, but that the cultural engagers have read it and don't like it.
Yeah.
They do not like it. And that I can tell you, they do not like it.
That is clear.
So their point of view, I think, and I understand why they don't like it. You know, so the people who are most, you know, the people with like really big audiences and platforms and things that read First Things magazine and saw this, they don't like it. So they're not keen to split. The group that has had by far the best positive reaction has been the seeker sensitive megachurch people, the broad evangelical types, you might say. When they encounter this work, they love it. So I've been doing a lot of like Christian radio shows and podcasts that, you know, my publisher booked me on. So people who didn't already know me, I'm amazed. They read the book. So they had me on to talk about the book. They read it and they were really engaged by the idea. They loved it. Like almost everybody in that space loves the idea. And they love it for this reason. They're like, now I know what I've been seeing out there. It's like, if it's like, it gave them like a language and a framework to understand what they were already seeing and experiencing.
Yeah.
And they love it. And so getting, and that's why it's great to be with Zondervan, because I think the more of those people who see it, they will really like it. So my sort of, the kind of style that I have is most aligned, I guess you'd say, with the cultural engagement world, but they just don't like it. But these other people really, really do like it. And it's interesting. I'm hearing, I think these people are more interested in like new cultural thinking, the seeker sensitives, than people give them credit for. So they really love what they love this stuff.
Well, it's their bread and butter.
Yeah.
I mean, the seeker sensitive, that whole seeker ethos was all, it's the relationship between the seeker sensitives and the cultural engagers is a really interesting one, because my history is much more with the cultural engagers, sort of Calvin University, that whole crew. And,
right. And you've done urban ministry too.
Yes. Yes.
So you've been in like multicultural, like, right. you know, that's all you've really known.
And the seeker sensitives are, you know, they both, you know, part of, you know, Molly Worthen's book, you know, Apostles of Reason, she charts out very well that both the seeker sensitives and the culture engagers will pay attention to psychology. And so they'll pay attention to psychology, the cultural engagers, because it's an academic sciencey thing. And so they're going to be with it on that. And the seeker sensitives, because they're going to find it useful for their mission, because the seeker sensitives tend to be missiologists looking for conversion, and the cultural engagers. Who was the Mark Lilo when he left Christianity Today and he wrote that, you know, the biggest thrill that they got was when they were quoted in the New York Times.
Right.
And of course they hated that.
You ever heard that? You know, there's a term in sociology or anthropology. I'm not sure which one it's called, cultural cringe. I don't know if you're familiar with it, but it was coined to describe Australia and this colonial mindset. The idea, if you're in a colonial environment like Australia, you have a sort of inherent inferiority complex versus the metropole, versus London and England. Everything from England is superior. Everything from Australia is inferior. You know, even our accents are funny. And, you know, we even have that in America. It's yeah. like, you know, it used to not be that way. You know, we didn't always think this way, but today anything that comes from England sounds posh. You know, it seems a little more sophisticated. I'm from Europe, you know, and so there is this, I think there is this sort of cultural cringe that these people have. And by the way, that's what's what Jordan Peterson does not have. Jordan Peterson does not feel a sense of cultural inferiority towards mainstream culture. So that he's very confident in what he says and how yeah. he approaches it. And you never, and I think this is the point, they don't have the confidence in what they're doing. So I think it's interesting. If you go back, you know, if you went back to the early days of Redeemer Church in New York, I think there probably was a lot of seeker type emphasis there. They were trying to crack the code on conversions.
Yep.
And in fact, it's interesting, you know, you read pieces like Kathy Keller. She wrote this piece 30 years, reflecting back on 30 years at Redeemer. The way she talked about how they did it was very seeker. In fact, she even used the term seeker.
Yeah,
it was very seeker-like language, and it was very successful.
Yeah,
you know, and they had had tons of converts in the 1990s and 2000s there
yep.
as a result of this. But, you know, by the time that I got, you know, connected with this new Calvinism thing, it had morphed into something else. It was probably not as conversion driven. Although Keller himself, I think, always viewed himself heavily as an evangelist.
Yeah.
And I think they're also, you know, I think, I've never talked to James Davison Hunter, I really think he's an extremely smart, insightful character. And he's clearly been an advisor and consultant to those people.
Yep.
And I think the cultural engagers have clearly heavily internalized James Davison Hunter's approach to cultural power, which in essence binds them into the status system of elite media. And so that's their strength and their weakness. The strength is that their buddy David Brooks will write articles, you know, taking their point of view, and that they've got great relationships at the Atlantic and all these places. The downside is they can't make those guys mad. Because they, and so that's where you kind of end up there.
Yeah. One of the things that I really appreciate about your work is you, unlike just about everybody else, a friend of mine who goes to church with Kristen Cobez-Dume told me that she was writing a book and she was taking a look at Jordan Peterson. Of course, I was doing videos about Jordan Peterson. And so he said, well, maybe you and Kristen should talk. I said, that'd be fine. I got my undergraduate degree in history from Calvin College. And, you know, these are the people that I've come from. And then when I got the book, I got the title and the subtitle of the book. Oh, the subtitle of the book is good. But then when I read the book, I was so thoroughly frustrated because to me, the real story of what has happened in the last 100 years in American Christianity is not so much the fact that people's religion and politics are intermet. I mean, that's normal. The real story is what happened to the mainline. And when you weren't there. So I was invited to Jordan Peterson's art conference in London. And that was fascinating because I caught Aaron, I can send you the link. Aaron Tornberg had a couple of Substack posts where he was talking about lions and foxes. And he was following somebody who had written about the fact that in the West, the WASPy elites were lions. They had confidence in their culture. They had confidence in their religion. And they intended to colonize the world with it. That was, they were lions. And they talked about how in many ways they became foxes where they, this is a tremendously complex narrative you have to follow because it has to go through dealing with Jim Crow and the American Civil Rights Movement and how that impacted the mainline churches And it has to deal with Roosevelt and Roosevelt's desire to widen WASPy American elites to include Catholics and Jews. And so you have this big movement in American history where the Christian aspect basically gets submerged, and where that nicely sort of factors into your thesis, it in fact gets so submerged it becomes antithetical, where Christians then are, now it's a negative thing to be a Christian. And what was amazing in England with respect to this was I was talking to Christian after Christian who would basically tell me things like, these are Christians who they go to church, they believe in the resurrection of the, they basically, when they recite the Apostles' Creed, this is what they believe. Okay.
Right.
And what the life that they live in England means that when they go to work, you really don't let people know this about yourself, because you know that if others know this about you, you might not get a promotion. You might not get another job. You might not be taken seriously. And that's the status in England of many Christians. And you see this, I think that's in many ways part of this turn into a negative world. But it's helpful to remember that those today who are despising Christianity either grew up as Christians or are the heirs of these WASPy elites. And so to me, the most interesting transformation is not really what has happened to culture warriors. They've been fairly consistent the whole time. The interesting story is what has happened to the other group. And I think it's for that reason, or at least partly for that reason, that the cultural engagers, they're really not going to like your book, because in some ways you're exposing a lot of the angst that is in their program that they, you know, in a sense, they have to kowtow. They, you know, as you said, they have to, when a true cultural elite walks down the street, they have to walk, you know, walking on the sidewalk, they have to step into the street and they have to be submissive. Please, won't you notice me? I mean, David French's career is in some ways, this is what they're dreaming of. I mean, if they could be elevated to be a columnist for the New York Times, that's what they want. So, and you're one of the few people that I've actually found helpful in terms of seeing this transformation of WASPy cultural elites who, in all of this complaining about Christian nationalism, I mean, I would mock them by saying, it's amazing how Donald Trump traveled in a time machine and put Gothic cathedrals in the middle of American cities and universities before he was even born. Because this business about Christian nationalism, it's like Christian nationalism was the project of America.
Right, and the mainline Protestants are the Christian, or the original Christian nationalists for sure.
That's right. They were the lions. And then suddenly, well, they've sort of, you know, what have they become and why? And I think for me, that is a much more important story to figure out than the fact that, well, guess what? Culture warriors have long since sort of been playing their own game, and for the most part, losing the whole time.
Right. And that's where, like, you know, to bring it back to Nassim Taleb, one of the things I like about him, when he wrote a great essay, it's in his book, Skin of the Game. It's called Intellectual Yet Idiot. And, you know, he really just has total contempt for the elites of modern American society. And, you know, the thing that really made him famous, you know, was going back to The Black Swan. He had his book, The Black Swan, and he has a little paragraph in there, and he's talking about Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the government guarantors. And, Peter Orszag, who was Obama's OMB chief, and I can't remember who it was. It might have been Stiglitz, the guy who won the Nobel Prize. they wrote this paper, you know, their analysis of the risks of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And it's basically like in the, even in the worst case scenario, you know, they've got like 10 times as much capital as they need. It's no problem. And in the Black Swan, he basically says, actually, from as far as I can tell, they're actually sitting on barrels of dynamite. And not only can they go bankrupt, it's almost certain that they will go bankrupt. And of course, shortly thereafter, they went bankrupt. And just like his willingness to just, these people are clown. Nobel Prize winning. This guy's a clown. Who does he think he is? Now, of course, I think Taleb's public style is rather, you know, somewhat off-putting to a lot of people. But until you break the cultural cringe, until you become a lion, you know, like Paul in the Bible, he was a lion. And, you know, he was confident what he was saying was true. And Peterson is, as, you know, as I wrote, I mean, he takes, you know, he thinks what he's doing is of the utmost moral seriousness. It is like this stuff matters. And so I don't think it needs, you need to be a lion in the culture war sense of fighting these political battles. But if you don't have the confidence in your own program to basically say, you know, the elites running our society, who actually aren't that great, in my opinion, they're objectively failures in a whole host of ways. When life expectancy is declining in your country, like, it's insane. Okay. And, you know, it's the horrible, I put up this just stunning, stunning chart from Le Monde Diplomatique, which was a chart of per capita healthcare spending by all the countries overlaid with changes in life expectancy over the past decade. And like, you know, we're paying like 2.5 times as much as the next nearest person, and our life expectancy has declined. We're one of only like 2 or 3 countries has declined, and we're now like as low as Lithuania. And like, so you start looking at that, and you're like, I'm supposed to respect these people? Like, no, I don't have to. They, you know, they can't build subway lines in New York for anything less than like 2 times the next highest people who also have absurd costs. And so until you start realizing that, like, you know, one, you know, I'm not saying I have all the answers, but like, the elites of our country are not impressive people. For them, not to say that they're all evil or they're all stupid, but they're, I think some of them, since they're caught in a bad system in a lot of ways. But at the end of the day, if you don't have that confidence, if you don't have the confidence of a lion, you're just going to be complete. You're going to be operating in that cringe mode. And they definitely operate in the cringe mode. And, you know, it's unfortunate that they do. And again, Jordan Peterson doesn't do that. And that is another thing for him. People are like, and again, that's even part of the Donald Trump, I think, phenomenon going back to 2015. He didn't spend any time, you know, condescending to cater to the sensibilities of the media class. He's like, I hold you in contempt. And people today are there's like a magnetic draw to people, I think, in a lot of ways. And so that was like one of the things that drew people to Peterson. Like, wow, this guy's not like kowtowing to these people. He's not even like apologetic about what he's saying. Like, I'm really sorry that I have to tell you this, but unfortunately, here's what the sign, you know, he's like, well, here's reality. And you could learn a lot from that. And he really, you know, and he is, you know, he was a Harvard professor, University of Toronto professor. He does have a PhD. Like, the guy actually does have some expertise, and he speaks very, very compellingly. And like, you know, why can't we have even one person that does that? You know, Tim Keller was like the one guy that people would say had that sort of pizzazz, if you will. But we don't really have those people.
Yeah. Well, and you also have been one of the, so when I look at the cultural engagers, I tend to, and again, that's my tribe. So mm-hmm. I come from the left side of the Christian Reformed Church, and I seriously wonder about their, I mean, they wanted Calvin and Wheaton to sort of be the Harvard and Yale of evangelicalism, but the status of that was always, you know, it would always be, this would be the Christian alternative to the Ivy Leagues. What do you think is the path forward? I mean, the culture warriors are going to continue to sort of, you know, I look at Doug Wilson, and my line for him has always been, you know, call me when you get to Boise, because he's clever. He knows how to work a meme. You know, he's certainly got some very cutting critiques of the powerful, but to me, his project looks like it's probably not going anywhere. And are we just in a negative world? Our Christians basically should say, okay, well, we're going to be food for lions for the next 100 years. Mm-hmm. Do you think that's where this goes for us?
Yeah. Well, you know, the culture war, you know, there's like all these people. I mean, like a lot of them are very heavily Pentecostal. You know, there's that whole like new apostolic reformation movement. And like, was like Paula White was, you know, Trump's big faith advisor. And, you know, there's like whole worlds of people that are gigantic that you and I never really come into contact with, yeah. You know, all that much. And I think a lot of the culture war comes out of, you know, a lot of people like that. And of course, so Doug Wilson is really an outlier, I think, in so many ways, you know, from that group. But, you know, I don't see them changing what they're doing too much. Although I think it wouldn't be too hard. I mean, if you come from sort of a fundamentalist background, you know, the fundamentalists were really kind of separatists. They weren't necessarily engaged in politics. You know, Jerry Falwell early on was like, you know, didn't do politics. He's like, that's not, we don't do, there's no, you know. And then he became political. So I think they could potentially depoliticize, but I see no evidence that they're going to do that. You know, and so I don't exactly say this in, you know, in the book, but this is the kind of paradigm I'm looking at, which is a little bit like Paul's, but what I think of as Paul's, you know, near-term ministry paradigm, which is this. I at one time wrote down every single command Paul issued in all of his letters, and I put them into different categories of instruction. And unfortunately, I lost this document and I can't find it in any of my back. I got to recreate it. But as I recall, his instructions were overwhelmingly fell into two categories. One was personal holiness. The other was unity in the church. And there were remarkably few commands of Paul that deal with the world outside of the church. And most of them are about how to accommodate yourself to it with the least amount of trouble. Pay taxes to whom taxes are due. You know, so far as it depends on you, be at peace with all men. He was far more interested in what was going on inside the church than what the Rome was up to. You know, he didn't really care about Rome, you know, all that much. And he didn't really have any, you know, much like Jesus, he didn't have like a big political reform agenda. He's not like, well, we got to like overturn these guys and all this stuff. And I think he was very clear in rejecting what they did, but he's like, well, I'm not worried about what they're doing. I'm worried about what you're doing. And I think that is very much the paradigm that we ought to be spending much, much more time worried on about what's going on in the church and a lot less time worrying about what other people are doing, you know, because, you know, they don't support what we would support anyway. And, you know, maybe we should just be, maybe a lot more like the Mormons, but with better theology, you know, in the sense that, you know, they have a super high functioning sort of, you know, world, not that it's perfect, you know, and they kind of do their thing. But, you know, very few people can even tell what the Mormon political, you know, and like, they don't seem to have that like agenda. They're, of course, they have this complex relationship with American history and all that, but, what I see instead is people who are very conformed to the world in a whole lot of ways, who have a lot of, you know, mistaken ideas around gender, of course, being one. But I don't see, you know, but I think there's probably a lot of areas where the evangelical church is just flat out wrong and needs to fix its theologies, fix what it's doing. And, you know, creating a sort of much more of a counterculture, much less trying to be relevant to everybody all the time, maximally relevant, and much more think about how do we have like something to invite people into, which has always been, you know, I think even internally, the seeker people have always kind of like worried, oh, we're not really discipling people. You know, Willow Creek did their famous survey of like, oh, we surveyed people. We don't think they're growing in their faith. And like, what's so wrong? And what do we have to do better? But I think that's a reality. It's like, you know, hey, when we're, you know, what do we have instead? We have, you know, a church that's saying, hey, we have more people showing up and single people showing up. So what we need to do is preach against the idolatry of the family. Is that really the big problem? You know, is talking about the gift of single? It's like, I don't have a problem. I feel like, okay, let's discern and align ourselves with the truth and create a church community that's, you know, living out, you know, the way that it's called. And that doesn't mean that you don't stop helping the poor, you stop doing evangelism, all these things, but, you know, recognizing that you're now in a minority position, you know, in the culture, you know, you need to react accordingly, I think.
I think that's a good word. I think that's a good place to, well, those are my questions. I don't know if you had anything you wanted to say or do, or I'll put the book is widely available. You can get it on Amazon. You can, I don't know. Are there still Christian bookstores? I don't.
I think there are. It's for sale in anywhere books are sold. Life in the Negative World: Confronting Challenges in Anti-Christian Culture. You should be able to buy it, and you can sign up for my newsletter too, AaronRun.com, where we talk about all these kinds of issues and more. And you know, I wish we had more conversations like this, and you know, viewers of that. I mean, it really is depressing sometimes, you know, it's just, but.
What's depressing?
You know, the lack of like curiosity about any of these topics and seriously, you know, wrestling about the, you know, like I find it interesting, you know, your videos, you frequently put these different YouTubers, these like Gen Z YouTubers and what they're up to. And just like what's going on in the world. I mean, I just think of this curiosity about what's going on in the world and like what's going on with metamodernity and what's going on with this and that. I, you know, and a willingness to like explore some of these issues. And, you know, again, I think Peterson's got a lot right, unfortunately. And, I don't see a lot of evidence that there's a lot of interest in reform and kind of evangelical land.
Yeah,
but be that as it may, I am not going to become Eastern Orthodox as the solution to that problem, which is what a lot of people are doing. And so,
that's another conversation. I don't know.
That's why I call it like post metamodernity. I think the quest for re-enchanted world is a major. Rod Dreher is very good at putting his finger on what's coming next. His book on reenchantment is going to be big.
Yeah.
I think Jordan Peterson's sort of Jungian symbolic stuff is like all like wrapped up in that. The everybody wanting to do psychedelics, go taking an ayahuasca trip or whatever, very into that.
Yeah.
It's very new agey, but people are looking for like some sort of some sort of enchanted experience. And that's one that I think is a big theme that, you know, the church needs to figure out how to speak into.
Yeah. I don't count out. I see in some ways and of course these movements take a long time. I think we are actually making progress. We have been making progress on many of the issues that forced the Protestant Reformation and some of the things that Protestant churches bring to the table. I think the other traditions have been maybe not admitting, but have been imbibing and using. And I actually think I think the church is going to be okay, as it always has been, and it'll continue to figure things out and find ways to live. And I think part of the success of Orthodoxy has been, in some ways, they have taken that approach that you just laid out. They are usually not culture warriors, but they are focusing on putting their own house in order and trying to help people live intergenerationally. And the only way you're going to live intergenerationally is going to be engaging in questions about family, because that's how we move intergenerationally. It's way too early to know what is going to happen with respect to this new crop of American evangelicals and post-Protestants that become Orthodox, and what that actually yields. We're in very, very early days for that.
Yep.
But
interesting times. I will say I'm not of the opinion that Christianity is holding a going out of business sale in America. It's not like we're going to be down to this ragtag fugitive fleet here anytime soon. And I think people who are betting on that are making a very bad bet.
Yeah. I know. I agree. And I think, that doesn't mean that things aren't going to be chaotic and rough, and we're not going to continue to see a huge transition we're going to see a lot of churches die, and we're going to see a lot of new things emerge. And there's going to be a lot of long-term sorting out of those things. This has been American church history.
And the post-boomer, the generational turnover from this boomer-dominated religious life into something else.
Yep.
In America and elsewhere, it's going to be very, very different.
Yep. Well, Aaron, I'm gonna end this recording, but I just want to thank you for taking the time.
Oh, thanks for having me. It was great.